Welcome back to another episode of Adoption Unfiltered. I'm adoptee Sarah Easterly, and as usual, I'm joined by birth parent Kelsey Vandervliet Ranyard and Lori Holden, an adoptive parent. And today we are so honored and so excited to have a very special guest with us, Dr. Joyce McGuire Pavo. Thank you, Dr. Joyce. We're so happy that you're here. This is just
I'm very pleased to be here.
Great. Well, I think almost everybody knows who you are. You almost probably don't need an introduction, but just because I want to give you an introduction, I will say that Dr. Joyce has worked for 55 years, you were just saying, in the fields of adoption, child welfare, family therapy, and more. She is an adoptee herself. She's a lecturer in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and she's consulted to various public and private child welfare agencies, adoption agencies, schools, community groups, as well as probate and family court judges, lawyers, and clergy. She's worked closely with individuals and families affected by adoption, foster care, and other complex blended family constructions. And she's the author of the book, The Family of Adoption, and also the forward author of our forthcoming book, Adoption Unfiltered, which was such a treat and an honor for you to have written that for us, Joyce. So thank you again for joining us. We're just delighted to be able to mine your experience and talk to you about all that you've seen in the 55 plus years working in adoption, not to mention your lived experience as well. So thank you again.
Thank you.
I think I'll start with the first question, which is, what prompted you to set out on your own journey of adoptee consciousness?
Good question. Well, you know, I'm 77 years old. So I was born in 1946. And when I was growing up, it was, you know, there really wasn't any discussion about adoption. It was, as B.J. Lipton would say, as if birth parents were told, oh, this will be as if it never happened and you'll get on with your life. And adoptive parents were told, this would be as if you had this baby and you'll raise this baby. And adoptees weren't told anything. They were just thrown into it. But I think that over the years, we've, you know, grown and thought about things. But when I was growing up, I was a curious person. My adoptive mom used to always think it was because I had red hair, that I had a temper and I had a curiosity, and she would blame it on my hair. But I think it had more to do with my adoption than my hair. And it had to do with really feeling like all of these secrets and puzzles were intriguing and nobody was talking about them. So I drove people crazy asking questions, and it was hard to get answers from people. And so I think that's what led me to this. And I knew originally I wanted to go to medical school and I was going to be a psychiatrist, but I hated science and math. So I found my way to being a psychologist and family therapist. And family therapist, because I was intrigued by families. My adoptive family was great. I mean, they didn't know anything, but it wasn't their fault. It was a sign of the times. They did their best and they were great people. You know, a lot of things weren't done that could have and should have, but it really wasn't their problem. It was the bigger picture of adoption's problem. And my birth family is fabulous. My birth mother was amazing. I mean, I feel very blessed, and I feel like it put me in a position to be able to do the work that I needed to do, because I didn't have any big dramatic negative feelings about any of the people in my life. But I did have strong feelings about the structure and the system of adoption and the way it affected family systems. So I made that my thing. And from a very young age, I would sleep overnight at my friends' houses, and I was being a sociologist. I would study their families. Like, how do real families act? You know, what if you weren't adopted? Would it be different? So I would watch and So I was always sort of investigating all of these things. So it was a natural. Funny story, I was a detective in the Virgin Islands when I was 19. And I feel like being a family therapist is like being a detective. And I feel like doing searches is like being a detective. So all of these things sort of, it's a confluence of interests that put me in this place. And I love mysteries. You know, I love to solve them. I spent the entire pandemic being an expert on Scandinavian murder mysteries. Watched every crazy thing that was on Netflix. And I just think this is a very complicated realm that we're in. And it requires that people acknowledge, first of all, that it is, and then do whatever they can to learn more about it and to change the things that need to be changed. Long answer to your short question.
I love that. I love that answer. Thank you. And I have one more. We want to go to the big picture, but I have one more question just on a personal level. So speaking of detective, and you mentioned your birth family, and did you have to do the detective work to find them?
I did. I searched when I was in my late teens, early 20s, and I didn't know anyone who had, I was inventing the wheel. I mean, I'm sure there were plenty of other people, I know there were, who had done similar things, but there wasn't an internet and there wasn't a way to figure it out. So I had a friend who had just become a lawyer, and I said to her, okay, now that you're a lawyer, you have to help me find my records. And she said, they don't teach us that. I said, well, you're going to figure it out and you're going to help me. And so she did. And we went to court and we got a woman judge who was the first woman judge appointed in Massachusetts, I think, or at least in my area. And she was terrific. And I asked for permission to see my original birth certificate and to look at my records, which are two different things. And it's one thing to get your original birth certificate, but records should be more private. And I even agree with that. They let me look at everything. So I had access and that was terrific. So I searched and I found my birth mother. And I wrote her a letter. I wrote her I wrote 8 million letters. And the one that I sent finally, and this was old school, Kelsey. It had to be like handwritten and sent in the mail. We didn't have, you know. So I wrote to her and said, I haven't seen you since August 20th, 1946. Let's do lunch. And I did that because I didn't want her to be embarrassed if anyone else read it. It sounded like I was an old friend or something. And I really wanted to preserve her choices about who she shared anything with. So I thought that, and it took me a long time to get to that crazy one sentence, but I did it. And then I sent it, when I put it in the mailbox, it disappeared out of my mind. And I felt like, I don't know what I felt, but I was shocked when she called. I gave my information and my phone number, and all of a sudden I got a phone call. And the idea that my birth mother could be at the other end of this wire was shocking to me, even though I'd initiated it. It was like, oh my God. And it was great. We met, and there's so many stories associated. One quickie. One of my brothers, when I met him, said it was astounding that she met me because she was agoraphobic and she never left the house, but she left to meet me. And, you know, I thought she was a little withholding because she didn't meet me more often. But in fact, this was gigantic.
I have a question I'd like to ask you, Joyce. I've been in the space probably 16 or 17 years. I was just thinking if my blog could get a driver's license, it would now be able to. So I'm curious from your vantage point, which is much longer than mine, what have you seen in terms of development of adoption practices, the emergence of adoptee voices the emergence of birth parent voices. I guess I'm kind of wondering, has it been like a steady arc towards progress, or has it been cyclical? We go forward and we go backward. We go forward and we go backward. Like feminism or other wave things that have waves. What does that arc look like for you?
Well, you know, it's jagged. I don't think it goes one way. I do think there really was very little early understanding or discussion about adoption. And I think people like B.J. Lifton wrote about it, but at that point in her early life, she was a journalist and a great writer. But it wasn't until very late in her life that she became a psychologist. So there's a difference. I think there was a growing awareness about the practice of adoption before there was any understanding of the mental health needs and the awareness about what was happening, first of all, to the adoptee and to everyone else. So I think in my experience, and we could spend 4 days, or that would be small, talking about this, because there's so many ways we could go with this. But in the early days, child welfare was trying to pay attention to all of these things. And organizations like NACAC were trying to pay attention to the adoptive parents and professionals. And AAC was an adoptee-led group that had birth parents. And I was one of the officers at the time that we did something that caused me to be vilified. I mean, the thing about all these groups is you go through phases of people think you're the most wonderful thing and you're, and then they think you're trash and you're terrible and how could you do this? I wanted to involve adoptive parents and professionals in AAC at that time because I felt like we all had to be talking to each other. I think we need our own groups because we can talk differently and explore ourselves. And then there was CUB, and the leader of CUB, Lee Campbell, was from around here. She's from New Hampshire. So she was around the same time. So there were all these emerging groups paying attention to birth parents, paying attention to adoptees, but they weren't together. And they were actually a little adversarial, and for good reason in some cases. I think that the adoptive parents and professionals were not really listening to the birth parents and adoptees. They were actually put off by what we were saying. I think they felt attacked. And it's true, there were criticisms. And I don't think people were very good at taking those criticisms. And maybe we weren't very good at leveling them. But so that was going on. And that was a whole period of time. There was a joining, I know I ran an AAC meeting in Boston in the 80s, and Ken Watson, who was, he ran a big agency in Chicago, he was a big child welfare person, he looked like Santa Claus or Uncle Sam, he was a great crazy guy. He was a keynote at this conference, and he got up and said, and this was a pivotal point, I think. He said, you know, if I had been an asbestos salesman early on, I would have been thrilled to have found a product that was saving so many people's lives. I could sell it. I could make a lot of money, and it was good for the public, and it was great, and I could feel good about myself. But then when I found out that asbestos was a carcinogenic, and that people were dying and it was a horrible thing, I wouldn't want to sell it anymore. And I'd want to get up and speak to people about the dangers of having this in their home or in their life. And he said, that's how I feel about adoption. And he was not adopted. He was not an adoptive parent. He was not a birth parent. He was a social worker. And he placed lots of children in lots of families and dealt with all of us. And he, I think he made a very good point about how it was really being done wrong and it was hurting people. And he had to get up and speak about it. So I think that was a turning point. I think that, you know, the mental health issues and the psychology of adoption in the 80s when I was at Harvard, nobody would pay any attention. I mean, I was really early on in the psychology of adoption piece. There were other people doing many things before me in the bigger picture. But when I was at Harvard, I would try to get people to be my mentors and to work with me. And they would say, Joyce, 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 you know, there's no psychology of adoption. And I would say, excuse me, I know there is. And I was lucky enough to have Eric Erickson as one of my professors. And he was half adopted. And he was a friend of the Liftons. And so BJ and Bob Lifton had him for dinner all the time and had me. So I got to meet him out of class and everything. And he was hard of hearing. So he would only have 6 to 8 people in a seminar. He wouldn't do big classes. So you got a lot from him. And he was terrific. He really understood what I was doing. My professor, who was my advisor, who I loved, interestingly, the week before I was defending my dissertation, he adopted a child. So it's a second marriage, and he adopted this child. And all of a sudden, he started redlining my dissertation and saying, I don't really agree with this. And I had to sit him down and have a real chat with him. And I said, you know, you're telling me I have to change a quote by someone else. That is in there and it's staying in there. And I said, don't you dare become some adoptive parent that's going to have a problem with this the week before my dissertation. Just don't go there. And so, but I had to make a lot of changes to keep him happy. And it's very interesting how we react to people doing these things to us. The other thing is adoptive parents really had all the power, and professionals. They had more resources and they had more power at conferences when they spoke, and they felt like they were talking about adoption, but they were always talking about their children. And sometimes they were telling way too much, and these were being recorded. And I had a huge problem with people recording information about the pathology of their 8-year-old and having it on tape for other people to hear in their car driving somewhere. And it had repercussions. So there were problems with that. And what I really tried to do, I had a conference every year on the Cape, and I tried to have I picked adoptive parents. I chose who was speaking. No one got to submit proposals and do it. I chose people who I knew could say the things that would help people to understand and move forward. And of course, this is by my choice. So, I mean, I'm not necessarily the end all and be all, but I knew what I wanted to do. And the adoptive parents that I had that would speak would talk about their experience, not about their kids. They would talk about their own. What I found sad in therapy was that the adoptive parents really weren't seen as having been traumatized if they had gone through infertility, if they, you know, really to understand everybody and to see how we were all being used by the system and misunderstood by the system was incredibly important. And it wasn't useful to have one set of people treated differently for the wrong reasons. So these were some of the things that were going on. I'm going to fast forward. We could go on forever with this, but it's not useful. I think it's been fabulous to watch the adoptees coming forth and the birth parents. I think the birth parents are the quiet secret sauce. They're people like Amy Sieg, Lee Campbell, there are a lot of people writing really great things. And, you know, The Girls Who Went Away was written by an adoptee, not a birth parent, but it's all birth parent voices. I think those are voices that are very important. I used to require that internationally adopted people read that wonderful book, I Wish for You a Beautiful Life. It's a compilation of letters from Korean birth parents. And I would tell people, it doesn't matter what country your child's from. These birth parents feel this way. And it's in everyone's best interest to hear their voice and to know how they feel. So the emergence of more voices has been incredibly important. More voices in general, but then in the mental health field, a large, and in research, I think the Korean adoptees really have taken over those fields in a great way. They, more so than everyone else, have done that. And, you know, people like Astrid, the voices from people adopted from different countries. And, you know, there's the baseline of Sarah and I are the little white girls. You know, we were in race adoptions in country. And I think it's important to know the baseline of what we all deal with, and then add on to it the complexity of what it's like to be transracially adopted, internationally adopted, older child adoptions. It's important to know the difference between public and private, the additional traumas that kids who have been in foster homes and have been in, you know, orphanages. You know, there are so many layers. And then I think a forgotten population that's getting a little bit of attention now for the wrong reasons, but it's good, is kinship adoptions. I think kinship adoptions should happen more and more, and they are, only because there aren't enough foster parents or adoptive parents, not because they're the best thing, I have to say. Sometimes they're not happening for the right reason, but they're happening. And one of the things that I think is very wrong, to me, those are some of the hardest adoptions, because they're like open adoptions didn't get the right amount of attention either. I mean, I do a lot of work with open adoptions and reopening, so-called open adoptions. You know, it takes a lot of work to make and maintain a relationship with everyone. It's really hard work, and I don't think we give it enough space or time or attention, and we need to give much more attention. And it's, you know, I often have the adoptive parents pay for the work with the birth parent if the birth parent isn't able to afford it. And the way I explain it is, you're looking to improve your child's mental health. This is the person who can do it. And so you want to make sure that he or she is able to say the things that need to be said honestly and truly, and to do it in the right pacing and the right time to help this child. And so if one party can't afford it, and sometimes, rarely, but sometimes the birth parent is the one who can afford to have the adoptive parent get those services. But I think it's very, very important. And what happens in kinship is even more complicated, because often the good sister adopts the bad sister's child. And so there's a lot of family mythology and crap, and there's a lot of negativity. And, you know, that's old family stuff that gets in the way of this child who's an adoptee, who's already got trauma. And this is just going to be even more traumatic. So we have a huge amount of work to do. But even before that, I think the whole adoption system needs to be taken down, deconstructed, and reconstructed. I think this is my fantasy. My fantasy is the word adoptive shouldn't be in there. That if your birth certificate should be the certificate of your birth, and everyone should also have a legal certificate of your legal parents, who may be your birth parents and may not. And I think that it's incredibly important that we be honest and clear about everything. And that I think any parent that isn't the birth parent is a step parent. They're not a foster parent. They're not an adopted parent. They're not a kinship parent. They're a parent who is also a part of the life of this child. I think names shouldn't be changed until a child is able to choose. And I think that it's incredibly important that we give much more attention to the reality and the truth. The biggest problem psychologically with adoption are the secrecy and the lies. And we wonder why 8-year-olds are liars. We have, every parent comes to me and says, my child lies all the time. Well, yeah, they've been lied to. You know, that's the way to fix that is to tell the truth and to model that. And so I think, you know, I'll stop here and I'll give you a chance to mull this over and respond.
I just want to thank you for that. That was amazing. There was so much wealth in that, 5 or 6, 7 minutes. I did want to make a couple of comments, though. I feel very vindicated by what you said about adoptive parents, that as if didn't serve anyone. And it, when you were talking later about how we, in open adoptions, when there's contact, we need to manage all these relationships. It takes a huge amount of emotional intelligence. And to think that you can just do that automatically is wrong. You mentioned the problems are secrets and lies. I would add in their simplification to think that it's just no big deal to have adoption as part of your family's story. It's a big deal for everybody involved. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Absolutely.
So I also wanted to add, because just the way I come into this field 6.5 years ago, and I placed my child 7 years ago. And so I'm so fresh and new to this field, but I feel like I've been able to be a sponge and learn from so many different people who came before me, and especially you, Joyce. I know we used to have working group meetings together, and so it's been just kind of just a real joy and pleasure to be in proximity with you and so many others who have been doing work for decades. And maybe it's just me being naive, but I feel that just the way things are going in this adoption sphere of advocacy and progress, I do feel like we are on the cusp of something. I don't think it's a complete deconstruction by any means, but I do feel that we have grown a really powerful momentum, and I'm hopeful to see where that goes. But I'm also, I guess I'm cautiously optimistic, because I've seen, just as Lori mentioned, I've seen so many things that you feel are making progress. They take another step back and the wave kind of crashes, and you just are stagnant. And I feel like, from what I've read, just doing a lot of research in my own advocacy work, and how you mentioned the 80s and how open adoption was, people were starting to do research and write things about some of the problems with adoption. And then it sort of just, I feel like maybe the 90s and the early 2000s brought this wave of neoliberalism and this surface level change. And that's where we really see, with the rise of the internet and these flowery marketing about adoption, none of it real, all of it a facade and a deflection of what's really going on under the surface. But I feel like that is coming to a head now, because the internet, people have figured out in the last 20 years how to use it, how to use it to speak, how to use it to be heard. And so I'm hopeful, even if that's naive, I'm hopeful that that goes somewhere positive in the light of the people impacted by adoption, positive for those groups that have been so long ignored. So, yeah.
I think, you know, we need two tracks. And I remember at one of my summer conferences, we had, we used to get people that would come from different countries, and we had British, well, I did an exchange program with my clinic and a British clinic. And we would send people over there, and they would send people. So they sent a bunch of people for the summer conference one year. And they were very angry about transracial adoption. And, you know, a lot of them weren't transracial adoptees, but they were people of different races that were in social work and psychology who were represented. And they were very angry about it and thought it shouldn't happen at all. There should never be transracial adoptions. And they were adamant about this. And one of the things that I said, and that I continue to say, is that, yeah, in the best of all possible worlds, I believe children should stay with their birth parents. And if they can't, they should stay with their extended family. And if they can't, they should stay with their extended community. And if they can't, they should not be in institutions. They should be brought up in a family. And that would be whatever we call it, an adopted a family. And that's important. And I don't think we've done enough work to find the families that would be before the adoption. But I think that families that are already formed shouldn't be beat up and torn apart. And what a lot of the advocacy people who I think if you're going to be an advocate, be an advocate, don't be the therapist. And if you're going to be an advocate, do it consciously aware that there are families that you should not split apart. These kids have had enough trauma, and you should not say they shouldn't be with this family. This family's white and they're African American. They shouldn't be there. Well, they are there, and they need to be somewhere, and they need not to be moved around and changed schools and changed lives. And, you know, so I think we have to look at this on two tracks. We have to be making changes and deconstructing the structure and the whole way that adoption is done and what it means. At the same time, we have to take care of the families that are already formed. And we can't do them a disservice. We have to be able, you know, if you don't believe in gay and lesbian adoptions, if you don't believe in transracial adoptions, then go and be an advocate to not have those happen. That's legit. If that's what you believe, you should do that. But don't hurt the families that are formed. They need to get the supports they need. They need to continue to grow and strengthen, and they need to be safe and secure. So I think it's extremely important not to get carried away. And a lot of the groups on Facebook and groups and podcasts and things are really quick to want to trash everyone. And I really care about the kids. I care. My focus is always with the child as the centerpiece. And, you know, you really can't do this to children. You know, we do have to change the whole thing. I'm gung-ho about that. But meanwhile, it can't be at the risk of hurting the lives of these kids.
I'm so glad you say that, Joyce. And I want to just reference a conversation I had yesterday with Astrid in the Adoption Mosaic Better Together group, because we were talking about just what, and you know, all of us who are adoptees in the group, it's a group with birth parents, adoptees, and adoptive parents. But those of us who are adoptees are trying to put ourselves in the shoes of what it would be like as a younger adoptee to have access to all of the information that's out there right now, calling out all of the problems, and how hard it would be to still be in relationship with your family. And like, how are we supporting those adoptees is a really big question that I have that makes me nervous. You know, like, I can't imagine. I didn't have information. I had to go on my own pace and my own schedule. So I'm curious what your thoughts are about that.
You know, the largest population that I'm seeing right now in therapy are adoptive parents of 20, 30, and 40 year olds. And the 20, 30, and 40 year olds are cutting off their adoptive parents. They're learning more about adoption, and they're angry, and they're taking it out on their parents. Some of them should probably, and many of them shouldn't. It's the safest thing to do because they trust their parents. But I think it's a natural stage once you're awakened to what's gone on, and once you are aware of the traumas that you have, to lash out in different ways. And I would hate to see an eight-year-old. Eight-year-olds are doing it in their own way. I don't think they can afford to lose their parents. I don't think they need to be sent to residential treatment programs right and left. I think they need the support of their family, and we need to make sure that happens in a normalized way. And the fact that we're seeing so many adult adoptees cutting off, I don't think it's good for any of us to cut people off unless they're severely traumatizing to us, and then it is. But I think that we need to find a way to balance, and to, you know, a lot of people feel the same way about birth parents. A lot of the adult adoptees are, you know, rejected by their birth parents and very angry at them and cut them off. A lot of birth parents are really wanting a relationship, but the adoptee is like, no. I think the best thing is if you can get to a place, you don't have to have a relationship with anyone you don't want to. Relationships you choose. But it's important not to hurt yourself in the process. And I think that's what's happening in a lot of these situations, because people don't know how to navigate this craziness and don't know what to do with their trauma. It's, you know, and once you realize you're traumatized, I think you feel more traumatized, you know, it's difficult because I don't think you fix some of it. It's permanent. But I think you can certainly react to it differently, and you can learn to control it and maintain it in different ways. And that's what people aren't getting enough help with.
I really value that, Joyce. And I want to say too, that sometimes I think we have to allow ourselves to progress through these stages too, because I've myself 5 years ago, you wouldn't catch me talking to any adoptive parents. I didn't want to talk to any of them. I didn't want to follow them on social media. I didn't want to interact with them in, you know, community spaces online or anything like that. But now, you know, I've progressed past that point, and I've also realized in a lot of ways I can't do this without speaking to adoptive parents, and realizing once I get past the, you know, the barriers and the perceptions that you may have of these people, that they're people behind them, and you get to know them for who they are and not what you think they are or the stereotypes. And I think we have to kind of sometimes move through that anger, let ourselves feel it, but then, you know, allow yourself to progress through that. And we've talked to adoptees as well through this process of writing the book that had the same feelings. Sarah, I know some of your contacts and friends have been, just after our roundtable that we held last year, they felt like their mind sort of exploded. Like, I'm talking to adoptive parents and I'm fine, and they're people and they have feelings and they're normal. And so just giving ourselves that grace and space to kind of grow and move through that is really powerful.
You know what the other thing that's really destructive is therapists who don't get it, who really diagnose people. I mean, there's a lot of pathologizing of all of us, but adoptees in particular There are phases and stages of development where you are angry at people and you're furious at people and you're acting out. And if you just see that and decide to give it a label and some medication and some treatment, it's not always right. And I found I ran a clinic for almost 30 years that was specifically for our population. And one of the things that would, one of the reasons it probably isn't still in existence is I didn't do everything very cost effectively. For instance, I really believe people can be trained best by doing co-therapy and being with a seasoned clinician and watching them. I don't think supervision is always enough because you tell your supervisor what you want to, and they don't necessarily see what happened in the moment. So we, you know, in family therapy in the 80s and 90s, we had a lot of videotaping of sessions and we did a lot of different kinds of things that I think really help to grow really good ethical therapists. But it costs a ton of money because you can't charge insurance companies for each of those clinicians. It's just one, there's crazy business reasons why this doesn't work. But I think it's really wrong not to pay attention to how we train people. And now that the internet's available, people diagnose everyone. I had an adoptive dad who called me. He was so funny. He called me and said, I figured it out. Figured out her diagnosis. She's bipolar. And she's an international adoptee, and I've been seeing her since she was five, and she's a handful, and I love her. She's a wild woman, but she is not bipolar. And so I said to him, you know, she's 12. Find me a 12-year-old who isn't bipolar. I mean, you know, that, and who are you to be diagnosing this kid? And teachers do it. Oh, this child has ADHD. You should put him on medication. How do you know? You know, he might just be traumatized, or he might just be anxious, or he might just be wild in the streets. I mean, you know, you don't have to have a diagnosis that then stays with someone. And the other thing is, when people transfer a child to a new therapist, they transfer the records, and the records have a diagnosis because the insurance requires that. And 9 out of 10 times that diagnosis stays with that kid forever. In my clinic, you couldn't have a diagnosis till you'd been seen for 3 months and you were given anxiety, because everyone is, or, you know, adjustment disorder, which all adoptees have. So, you know, I don't think you can pass along these crazy diagnoses. People aren't always who they appear to be. And you can go through your angry stage, Kelsey. And if someone saw you during that stage, they would have said, uh-oh, Kelsey has blah, 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 blah. I mean, you know, but you were going through a stage of development and processing how you felt about this. And that's normal. So anyway, I think there's a lot that we're doing wrong, and we really need to get other people. I tried to train doctors, and there's not enough training in any of the fields that interface with us. So it's very hard to find people that are adoption competent. Still.
I'm wondering what things give you hope. Where do you see that we have made progress?
I think we've made progress. I mean, I think the fact that we have all these adult adoptee voices. Really, adoption is about children. All the adults are important. The birth parents are important. The adoptive parents are important. Everybody's important. But you wouldn't be talking about adoption if there wasn't a kid. So the child is the centerpiece. And it's really, really important that we realize that and we pay attention to it. And so the fact that we now have the voices of all these children who have become adults, and their voices are all different. Some of them think this, some of them think that. But, you know, it's just important to realize those voices are really real and they impact us a great deal. And it's also important to hear more from the birth parents, I think. And it's really important to hear from the adoptive parents, not just about managing the difficulty of their traumatized children, which is valid and real, but what about you? What I want to hear about you. I want to hear about what is going on for you. You know, I didn't even think that my adoptive mom had any issues until the day that I was babysitting. I tell this story, so you might have heard it somewhere, but I was babysitting and the mom hadn't gone out yet. She was upstairs getting dressed and I was playing with Stephanie, who was two. And all of a sudden I heard a blood-curdling scream and the mom yelled down to me and said, "Will you call your mom and tell her to come over right away?" And long story short, the mom was having a miscarriage. And so I held Stephanie and stood at the bottom of the stairs and heard the conversation between my mother and Stephanie's mom. And my mom said to her, "You know, I had 3 miscarriages and it was terrible. And I know this is awful." And, you know, and she helped her and then we got medical help and everything. But all of a sudden I realized that my mother had had losses. I didn't really get it until then. And I realized that she had dealt with losses in addition to my birth mother losing a child and what I felt I had lost. And I think we need to hear that. We need to know what it's like. We don't need just I think people try to present because adoptive parents have to present as pretty okay. So they'll be taken care of. I think we need to hear more about the trauma, the difficulty, the pain, and the process because it affects all of us.
One of my podcast guests said, "We all come to adoption on our knees." Mm-hmm. It's relevant here.
Yeah.
What an amazing, rich conversation, Joyce. I just feel really lucky that we had you to share your wisdom and your experience. I feel like we've only scratched the surface of what you have to share. So I want to have you back on the show again. But again, just thank you so much. And thanks to everyone for tuning in. We're so thankful for you watching and listening. If you liked it, please like, comment, rate all the things, share it wherever you help other people find Adoption Unfiltered, and visit adoptionunfiltered.com for more episodes. Thank you so much.